HPPodcast.com.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to June's Comments Show. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey.
This is all part of the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At HPPodcraft.com, and this is a patrons-only show, so if you're a patron, you're listening to this. And if you're not a patron, how'd you get a hold of this thing?
Get out of here, buddy. You don't belong here.
Get out of here.
You weren't on the list.
So now that it's just us.
Now I want you all to feel like we've got our arms around you, we're pulling you in close. Let's talk about some comments.
First, let's comment on the comment show.
Yeah, we did a comments show. People wrote in to that, and they said nice things that they liked it.
Yes, and we got a lot of support for cursing, which is surprising.
Yeah, a lot of people were like, oh, I didn't mind the cursing at all. In fact, I want more of it. So that was an interesting reaction. And to all you folks, I say, fuck you. I'll pull out this one comment that I thought was funny from Make America Great Old Ones again. The comment said, consider me encouraged to start commenting. Great show, gents. Kool-Aid Manning will enter my lexicon somewhere near Gymkhana-ing the pommel horse of my heart. Which is pretty good. And clearly he knows that any reference to Gymkhana, I will appreciate.
Oh my god,
that's a way into my heart because I love that movie. But we were in the middle of doing Bartleby the Scrivener when we interrupted with our comments show.
We have some more comments from the second episode of Bartleby the Scrivener. Michael Cunliffe says, Bartleby really does seem to fit the idea of terror as described by King and referenced in the podcast before. Bartleby is a normal human employee but slowly becomes something unnatural until, like the Raven, he becomes an empty reflection of the narrator's own fears and frustration. You know, if Poe had employed the Raven to do his taxes or something.
Yeah, no, actually, that's a really cool connection. I didn't think of it in those terms, but if the Raven were up there with Little Visor, it'd be pretty much the same story.
Pretty exactly.
Andrew Turnasek writes, cool story, but is it weird fiction? Strange, cryptic, yes, but weird, I wouldn't have thought so. Nevertheless, enjoyed the episodes. Also, as an employer of many years, Bartleby still wouldn't make it into my 10 worst employees list. Agreed. You know, man, there were a lot of stories that I was telling that hit the cutting room floor because they were just kind of boring, but it was just me complaining about employees I'd had before.
Yeah, we recorded for about 3.5 hours.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah,
it was a long, long session. Is this a weird story? That's a good question. Lovecraft wrote in 1927, the weird tale has something more than secret murder, bloody bones, or sheeted form clanking chains. Instead, it represents the pursuit of some indefinable and perhaps maddeningly unreachable understanding of the world beyond the mundane. A certain atmosphere of breathless and unexplainable dread, or malign and particular suspension or defeat of fixed laws of nature. Through fiction that comes from the more unsettling, shadowy side of the fantastical tradition. Mm-hmm. So to me, weird is an uneasiness, like a sense of the other. And if it's something that you can put your finger on, then it's not weird. So,
right.
Like Nightmare on Elm Street, sure, it's supernatural, but it's not weird.
Yeah.
Friday the 13th, it's not weird. On the surface, I know what they are. It's like a killer who goes into your dreams. Okay, I got it. A disabled kid seeking revenge. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. It's all something that we can quantify. But when there's an element of the unknown, a lack of understanding on my part, that's either something I don't understand or can't possibly understand, that's when it becomes a weird tale.
Yeah, agree.
So when Bartleby, is that really a weird tale? I guess technically from what Lovecraft said, it doesn't really, but I felt that sense of the other when I was reading it. Something was going on here that is beyond my understanding, not only how Bartleby was acting, but how he made others act.
Right.
And that was what was so unnatural, unreal, strange, weird.
Lovecraft says it's something, a suspension or defeat of the fixed laws of nature. Mm-hmm. I think if we can expand that operational definition a little bit, the fixed laws of nature to apply to the workplace, there are certain customs and rules that we're all used to.
Yeah.
And Bartleby was breaking them and we didn't know exactly why. So in that narrow view of it, I do think it was a weird tale.
Yeah.
Instead of it being cosmic, it was just within society. But it was done in such an odd way that you couldn't understand, you know, so there.
Yes. Yes.
So in that respect, it was weird.
If Bartleby jumped up on the desk and pooed on the guy's documents, then sure, I get that. That makes sense. Everybody's wanted to do that.
Yes.
That's just you pull that little switch in the back of your head that stops you from doing crazy stuff. But what Bartleby was doing, I don't quite understand. It's just beyond my vision. Like, I can't quite see it. And for me, that really just feels weird.
Yeah, the laws were slowly being stripped away until finally there were none at all. So it was like at first he was just refusing simple things, then he was refusing to do anything at all. Then you realize he's just standing and staring out the window all day. Mm. One of our commenters, Drix, says, to me, this definitely read as a weird tale. I had an image in my mind of Bartleby just standing and staring out the window at the brick wall in all of his spare time, even late at night, all alone. Can you imagine passing under that window on your way home and seeing that? Pretty creepy stuff. Agreed. Well, at least we can all agree that it does have an aspect of the creepy to it.
Well, yeah.
the word we perhaps overuse the most on this show.
We love that word.
By the way, when I think it's important when you talk about folks with disabilities that you put the person first and the disability second.
Yeah.
So you don't want to say a disabled kid. When you were talking about Jason,
yeah.
I think it's important you say he's a maniacal murdering killer of teenagers with a disability.
Oh, okay.
Not a disabled maniacal.
That's true. Yeah.
I'm just standing up for Jason, you know.
Yeah, put the person first, the disability.
Put the sociopathic murderer first, put the disability second.
Exactly. Duly noted. Thank you.
Yes.
Allison Albright says, I had a job with the county a few years ago, and I'm not sure if it was some aspect of employment law for the government workers or just that particular HR department, but it was impossible to fire anyone. Mm. I had several employees who didn't want to do their work, but didn't seem to want to do anything else either. It was one of the most frustrating experiences of my life. This story brought it all back.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's a somewhat common experience for anyone who's managed employees. This story may have deeper meaning or symbolism, but for me, it worked in a more straightforward way as well. That job was a nightmare. I think that this story can absolutely be classified as weird fiction. There's definitely something uncanny about Bartleby and how he manages to ensnare the protagonist so effectively just by saying he'd rather not do anything that was asked of him.
Definitely works on that level. I mean, that was the most engaging part of it, especially if you've been in that position before. Yeah, agreed. Running Head writes, loved it. Good to see Chris giving Dick Van Dyke a run for his money. In Mary Poppins, Scrivener means a copyist. Dick is referring to his trade as a pavement chalk artist, which frequently involves the reproduction of famous artworks in chalk. So but he is a copyist.
He's a scriver. He's not a scrivener.
He's not a scrivener?
I was making a joke.
Oh. Follow up on the next comment show, we'll find out. Though the story is less conventionally weird, I appreciated the way that, as Chad pointed out, it provides a superb characterization of depression, specifically that type fomented by this frustration of one's art. As a scrivener myself for 20 years, first as a ghost illustrator and now as copywriter for a legal team, it resonated strongly with me. That guy just full-on admitted to being a ghost.
Oh my gosh, wow.
That's the real horror.
Thanks, Running Head. Marcus Lauer says, Melville is often cited as a precursor to Kafka. Bartleby, in particular, is seen as an early instance of exploring the absurdity and eventual futility of the human condition, a concept that would later form the ideological core of Kafka's entire work. While there is certainly a lot of truth to that claim, I think it is interesting to point out a notable difference in the approach that separates Bartleby from such works as The Castle or The Trial. In Kafka's text, the reader usually witnesses the events through the eyes of an ordinary to the point of nameless character struggling against an inscrutable and all-powerful system and unfailingly being consumed by it in the end. Had Kafka written Bartleby, we would have gotten a Scrivener protagonist whose hopeless protest of I would prefer not to in the face of an endless stream of mind-numbing copywork was designed to elicit the reader's sympathy. Melville, on the other hand, decided to tell his story from the viewpoint of one of the system's agents, a lawyer. In doing so, Bartleby necessarily becomes a very cryptic figure, since the system he directs his polite protest against is never painted as this crushing and unfathomable Moloch one tends to find in Kafka's work. This, I feel, makes Melville's story all the more intriguing, as the reader is given basically no incentive to empathize with Bartleby's strange behavior, and yet, just as the narrator, we cannot help but pity Bartleby, this curious man who we might as well call Everyman.
So he's saying that Kafka would have put us firmly in the mind of Bartleby. We would have empathized with him more, or at least sympathized, whereas here, because he flips it, yeah, I mean, I agree with that.
Yeah. I just thought it was...
I think that's a good differentiation between the two authors, if they are compared a lot. I haven't heard Melville compared to Kafka a lot, but I don't really hang out in...
You hang out with me.
I hang out with you, and we don't know what we're talking about. So those
have
things
no idea what we're talking about.
A lot more conversations about Peter Parker versus Miles Morales.
Yeah, but we've discussed throwing some Kafka on this show before, haven't we?
Yeah.
And that's something we still might do in the future.
Well, similar to Spider-Man, he's got a story about a guy that turns into a cockroach and fights crime. So I'd like to get to that one at some point.
There you go.
Here's a comment from Make America Great Old Ones Again. First and foremost, I'm shocked at the lack of references to a very special episode of Head of the Class, in which a new student continuously and enigmatically says that he would prefer not to. My Googling skills almost failed me, but perhaps someone else could find it. That episode was my introduction to the story. I used to watch that show.
I did watch that show. I tried to Google it as well because I wasn't sure if you're pulling our legs or not.
Yeah.
Because if that is actually in an episode of Head of the Class, that would blow my mind.
Comment continues on. On a more serious note, I find the story a good example of the clash of explicit and implicit communication styles. I found this really interesting. Mm-hmm. English speakers tend to be very explicit. It is the job of speakers to make themselves understood so listeners feel free to ask for explanation. When that explanation is not forthcoming, there's a great deal of confusion. I live in Tokyo, where communication tends toward the implicit. It is the listener's job to grasp what the speaker intended, regardless of clarity. I've heard many Bartleby-esque stories from my years here. When an implicit speaker says, "I would prefer not to," they feel they've said everything they need to. It's up to us to work out any deeper meaning. And I suppose I should just point out that Bartleby never actually flat out refuses to do things. He states his preference and leaves it in the other person's court. Passive aggressive to the end.
Yeah.
That certainly is what's interesting about how he manipulates everybody. And that's what creates the internal psychodrama that characterizes much of the story.
Yeah.
But I remember when I was studying linguistics, we talked about clashes between East and West styles of communication a lot, and this would come up. There was a study that I remember reading about American English speakers communicating with Japanese speakers about business.
Yeah.
And how the Japanese speakers often would grow really impatient because American English speakers tend to just go on until they feel their... It's what he's saying here, basically.
Yeah.
You know, you have to... You explain everything and you expect to be allowed the space to do so. Whereas the Japanese speakers, once they understand what you're saying, you can stop talking. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
So the Americans perceive them as really rude because they'd be in the middle of talking and they just go, I get it.
Yeah.
Which is super rude to do to people here, you know? Yeah. So it caused them to have basic mistrust of each other. But it's just really, it's a cultural thing in how we digest communications. I don't know what's better. I mean, obviously, I like going on.
Boy, do you.
But there are days, certainly, when I'm listening to other people and I go, okay, can I cut you off now because I really know where this is going?
Yeah. Andrew Blank writes, I quite enjoyed your guys' coverage of this story. My initial impression was that Melville wrote this in reference to Henry David Thoreau's Attitudes of Civil Disobedience. I've actually read that somewhere as well, that this story was his take on the stuff that was going on with Thoreau and Emerson and all.
Yeah, it was a reaction to that whole transcendental movement. We talked about that a little bit then. I don't think it made the show.
No, yeah, I think it hit the floor. Henry David Thoreau's Attitudes of Civil Disobedience, which also resulted in his arrest. I assume that Melville had written the character of Bartleby as a parody of Thoreau's attitudes towards the mundane, but civilly necessary tasks such as paying taxes, etc. However, upon hearing your discussion of it, I find that I much prefer the idea that Melville wrote this as a reflection of his own despair and loss of will to write and possibly to live. I believe that the narrator's reflections on Bartleby reinforced this reading of the story. I also enjoyed Chad's comments on depression as Bartleby's indifference towards the world around him and his future, while displaying a near indomitable will in his inaction, resonated quite a lot with me, having battled with severe depression in the past. The Brokeback Mountain joke made my evening, and I very much look forward to Ang Lee's adaptation of this story, Bartleby Mountain.
I prefer not to quit you.
That's what it was.
Yeah, well, you know, having worked in offices as an editor and been very unhappy with my life in certain periods, I think that definitely resonated with me as well, you know?
Sure.
You guys want to hear about that for a while?
That's Chad's other podcast that he's going to be doing.
The Eeyore cast. Sellers Bergener writes, this story doesn't seem to have a great many themes woven into it, too many perhaps to pin down. I think, like a lot of great works of art, it's an expression of a mood brought on by an amalgamation of experiences, all pointing to the same sense of futility. It reminds me of one of Melville's Redburn stories we read in high school, I forget which. The narrator finds a woman huddled in an alley, frozen to death. Beneath her coat are two frozen children and a baby suckling at her breast. The baby is still alive. He asks a variety of people for help to rescue this poor baby, but no one wants to take the time or responsibility to do anything at all. When he returns to the alley, the baby is dead.
Oh.
The story seems to be a play on that same theme of futility.
God.
In this case, the living ghost from the dead letter office who has long since realized everything is futile and that we all end up just going into the dead letter pile in the end and then into the flames. And in the same sense, I definitely feel it has a profound impact on weird fiction, not only for the reasons you gentlemen pointed out, but also because of its technique of evoking a mood and leaving you with a lurid sense of being disturbed by something you can't see or do anything about.
Mm.
Yes, which was mentioned explicitly in the text.
Yeah.
At some point, he got so sick of Bartleby and repulsed by him because after a while you realize I can't do anything about this.
Yeah.
And that is a horrible, horrible feeling that I think a lot of us are sitting with all of the time. So it was, it's a great story. I'm glad that you guys responded to it. I was worried that that one might fall flat, actually, before we jumped in there. So I think it turned out to be a great couple of episodes.
Yeah.
Now, moving on to our special topic of the month. Last month, we did Lovecraft film and television.
That's right.
And let me kick off with a couple of criticisms. John Burkhart writes, "Sorry, guys, I was pretty underwhelmed by this first attempt at the topics show. I thought about why that was, as normally I'm someone who celebrates the whole Pfeiffer-Lackey catalog."
Thank you.
You haven't seen the whole catalog, otherwise you'd take that one back. But I think it was because the topic of Lovecraftian film and television is just too large to go over as a whole. For example, I'd have loved you to do a whole episode just on Cast a Deadly Spell, which is one of my favorite films as well. Mm-hmm. I agree with you there.
Yeah.
And actually, Tia Bowman also wrote, "I really enjoy your podcast, but I know this format is new. I would like it if it were more focused for the bonus shows, maybe going more behind the scenes with you, just an idea." Mm-hmm. "This show felt more like a list. If it had been more narrow, like if you just talked about the Lovecraft movies you've been part of, that would have been more interesting for me." Huh. I understand and somewhat agree with both of those comments because we were casting around for ideas for what to do the special topics show on, and we were looking at more specific stuff, but overwhelmingly, like, well, I say overwhelmingly, you know, five or six people said, "Why don't you do film and television?" I feel like we touch on that all the time.
Yeah.
Like when we're doing a story, we'll reference a movie that's an adaptation of it or something we've seen. So I feel like that comes up a lot. So I was surprised. But then I also thought, gosh, there's so much out there about this already as well.
Yeah.
That in the end, maybe it would have been better to be a little more focused. So when you are requesting these special topic shows for us, folks, give us some more specific topics to talk about.
Yeah.
See how I'm putting it off on them.
Yeah, I love this idea of doing a whole episode on Cast a Deadly Spell. That would be awesome.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. Some people have suggested as special topics like other books or other stories. That's kind of not what we want to do with those shows.
No.
That we want to go totally off topic and probably talk a little more off the cuff as well instead of having to study about it. But anyway, I do appreciate those comments. And anytime you guys think we are maybe getting off track, please write in and tell us.
Yeah. We're open, man.
Chris gets upset, but what? I love it. I feed off of it.
I don't get upset. Not at all.
He gets upset and he cries, and then I drink those sweet, sweet tears.
It's what keeps you so young.
The great thing about that show, though, was that a lot of people wrote in and said, "How could you have forgotten X, Y, and Z?" And that just created another huge list of things that we're going to get to check out. So actually, at some point, we might do a follow-up show after we've checked those. Yeah.
There's a bunch that I've got to see, movies I want to see because people have pointed those out. And then I went and looked them up and saw the trailers and was like, oh, whoa, I got to watch that movie.
So those did not get unlistened to, for sure. We're going to check all that stuff out and then probably bring it up in future shows or do another, you know, focus in on some of that stuff. Because we got a lot of things about Japanese Lovecraftian movies and animations.
Yeah, anime and cinema that is Lovecraftian and Japanese cinema, which, you know, I haven't seen any of those things. So
if Godzilla's not in it, I probably haven't seen it.
So let's move on to Mimic. Michael Cunliffe, again, he writes, "That final reveal elevates the story into a Lovecraftian idea of horror for me. What is otherwise a weird tale that has the creepy idea that we are sharing our world with a race of big monsters suddenly opens to the idea that we are living alongside an entire ecosystem of monsters we weren't aware of. For me, that really brings home the cosmic horror of just how little we know, how insignificant we are, and how horrifying it is to glimpse a much, much larger universe."
Yeah.
Agreed.
I love that ending.
It's a great ending and, you know, to a so-so story that the ending actually just really elevated it up.
Elevated up. That's what I say to writers. "Make America Great Old Ones Again" wrote on this, again. "I think the writer's mistake was in choice of narrator. If you're going to take us through the POV of a very well-educated museum curator specializing in bugs that imitate other things, we're going to expect brilliant insights and well-honed phrases. If, on the other hand, we were seeing all this through the eyes of the building's janitor, a certain clumsiness and confusion with how to express what he'd experienced might actually have added to the story's impact."
Yeah, I thought that was a good point.
That's true.
Because a lot of the things that he was talking about, insects in the beginning, where he's like, well, there's this species that does this. And then I went and actually looked up those species, and either he got the information wrong or it doesn't quite exist the way that he described it. He could have done it in a more succinct way. So if it was a janitor talking about these things, then yeah, that would make a little bit more sense.
Yeah, the janitor would just have to recount the same story I did on the episode. Go, "I saw a walking stick once. Isn't that crazy?" And then we'd already get everything that the entomologist said in there, right?
True.
Oh, okay. Things mimics other stuff. I get it. Yeah. Then he could talk about all the cockroaches he's wrestling with all the time and how they keep coming back. I can totally see the story from the janitor's perspective.
Yeah.
You know, he's having problems at home. And anyway, so Nick Booth writes, "Ant speed, Mr. Sulu," which is pretty funny. And if you listen to the episode, you'll get it.
I loved it.
Ant speed.
Clyde Dunsing III says, hey guys, I enjoyed the episode and was particularly amused by Chan's imitation of the reader making fun of the writing. That was Greg Johnson.
That's my favorite comment so far because I am usually on the writer's side of things. Uh-huh. So, you know, I get to sit back while actors get credit for things that I came up with, which is always right. A really good feeling. So I'm glad in this case that I got credit, even though he's aware that I'm reading Greg's thing. I love it. He was amused. He wasn't amused by what Greg wrote. He was amused by my imitation of Greg making fun of the writing. Oh, I love it. All right, keep going.
He says, I have to say, though, that the concept, the payoff, and particularly the implications of the final scene made the story powerful and worthwhile. I could see why this story struck Del Toro in such a way to drive him to adapt it. I would love to see what he would have done with it now when he had full creative control.
He's got that director's cut of it that came out in 2011. Yes. I don't know if he would have done anything that much different, but I agree that it's a great jumping off point. I mean, yes. This is the kind of story you want to adapt because then you're not going to feel bad about taking liberties. There's just
exactly.
There's enough there to suggest something, but then you can go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
This was an interesting comment from Running Head. Great show again, guys. I feel sure that the fear the mimic has for other females is a product of Wolheim's research for the story. For many colonial insects, the only breeding female is the queen, and the only serious threat to the queen is the appearance of another queen.
Oh.
So this might have to do with why she was freaked out by seeing other females, because in that insect society, there wouldn't be other females unless they were there to take over. So that was the first time that that suddenly made sense to me.
Yeah. I'll decide to give Wolheim credit and say that that is what he intended.
Well, there were some other theories.
Sure.
Elisheba, not sure, wrote, as a woman, I am definitely instinctively jealous of females who get all the benefits of male privilege as well as extra arms. You have a point there. That is an instinct of jealousy, probably. Allison Albright wrote, it seemed like the author meant that this insect and human woman might be jealous of each other in sort of a territorial sense, like they're each afraid the other will be competition for mates. Similar to what he was saying.
Sort of.
But that's the weird thing to suggest. I'm not afraid that non-human females would be in competition for human men. That's a good point. What does the author think women are like? I was having a really good time at the beach, but I'm pretty sure that female pelican is flirting with my boyfriend, so we're about to throw down. Also, I think a female insect, which has evolved to mimic a creepy guy in a big black coat, would be pretty safe from discovery around women. We're not going to be looking closely at him. We're going to try desperately to avoid eye contact or drawing any attention to ourselves while getting away from the dude as fast as possible.
Yeah.
That guy in the big black coat has a thorax and is staring at me. Oh God, keep walking. Don't make eye contact. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. I think Allison is on the money with that, for sure.
All very funny. Nicholas Moore wrote something about me flubbing up how natural selection works.
So Nicholas Moore says, I once argued with a naturalist who believed all genetic mutations were indeed random and accidental, caused by the sun's radiation making changes to the DNA of creatures over thousands of years. Certain mutations benefited creatures and certain ones did not. It was all chance. Yet, no well-respected member of the scientific community actually believes this theory, it seems. There are many, also, that believe random mutations happen at a cellular level when DNA is not copied perfectly over time during reproduction, and this causes a new genetic alteration that is either beneficial to the creature or detrimental, yet still all an element of chance.
That's been my understanding.
I'm not sure where this all begins myself and how much the element of chance is actually involved, but it's crazy to me to think that out of all these random mutations, we would have so many beneficial ones. It does seem to me to be an insanely specific process, as mentioned in the show, like there's more order in the universe than we might suppose through the scope of Lovecraftian cosmoses.
My understanding has always been that there are random mutations that happen at the cellular level, and then they die out, or they're teased out to become something more functional by the environment.
Yeah.
So there's an element of both something happened randomly, but because it was beneficial, then it develops over time because the environment influences it, right? Like you were saying about how cells become receptive to light and then gradually develop into eyes. So like the eye itself is not the random thing that happened.
No.
It was just that something beneficial on a much more primal level happened that got influenced by the environment, right? That was always my understanding of it.
Yes, just to reiterate what I had said and maybe say it in a way that makes a little bit more sense. Yeah, there is something that triggers a mutation and it is random, but the fact that it is more useful to the creature and natural selection keeps that around and keeps beneficial mutations.
Yes.
In so that
and that's not random other than
that's not random at all.
It's where the creature lives. I mean, there are random factors in terms of where is the creature, what's the predation, what's happening in the environment, but all of those things focus on the creature, and the creature therefore develops the characteristics it needs to survive in that environment. And it doesn't even seem that insanely specific to me when you consider the length of time involved and the number of possible mutations. It really doesn't seem that crazy to me at all.
Obviously, I'm a naturalist, and so I believe that these things happen naturally. A lot of people that are creationists use specific examples of living organisms and their complexity as evidence of a creator. Mm-hmm. I can understand how they can come to that conclusion. If they say, well, oh, you think it just happened by chance? It was just random that these things happen? It's like, well, no, I don't think it was just random. Like dice, all of a sudden a bug woke up one day and had an eyeball, you know, that didn't have before.
Yeah.
This is something, it's the natural selection, a process that happens over millions of years that does happen for a reason because these attributes are beneficial. So that's where I was coming from.
Yeah.
But if you ultimately look at the universe, everything is completely random. The why everything works the way that it does, I think, is just ultimately random. We can find reasons, you know, A to B to C to D, but why initially A?
Yeah.
Why was that there? Who knows? It's crazy. This is the universe.
Yeah. It's like, you know, when I make a tuna fish sandwich, I tend to put a lot of Miracle Whip in there.
Yeah.
Because I was, you know, randomly being from the Quad Cities. That's what you do. But now when I make a tuna fish sandwich for my wife, she goes, hey, don't put that. What are you doing? That's gross. Don't put all that stuff in there. And so the environment caused me to put less.
Yeah.
I don't even use Miracle Whip. I use mayonnaise, even though that's not the way I prefer. So, I mean, in a nutshell, that's how evolution works.
Pretty much. Yeah, you've got it, Pfeiffer. That's it.
I did want to... We're not going to get into the Vegetable Man because we just released that, and we'll do that on the next comments show. But yes. There was one comment on there that made me laugh that I saw right away. This is from Austin Tarot, and it says, drink every time Chad says, I'm reading this from Wikipedia right now. Yeah, don't do that. You're going to get poisoned. But the truth, it is kind of a weak... I feel really weak inside when I say that, actually, because citing Wikipedia, which in then and of itself cites a bunch of sources.
Yeah.
It just seems like... I just don't want to ever read it and pretend that it's my word.
No.
So sometimes I look at Wikipedia... I always look at Wikipedia when we do these
shows. We always look at...
throw
them
together so fast.
Yeah.
But then I try and drill down to the sources and find things that are more interesting or that might appeal to me.
Yes.
Sometimes... I go, I don't want to drill down on this. I just want to say it. So if that's the case, then I'm just going to say, okay, this is what it says on Wikipedia and not bother to paraphrase or rewrite or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of laziness, but then it's also like no more needs to be said on this topic.
Yeah.
If it's just a simple biographical fact or something like that.
It wasn't just you. I believe I also pulled the Wikipedia.
Sure.
Reading his legends.
Well, there have been plenty of times where I have cited it and not said that, and I feel guilty because some other editor somewhere wrote that.
Yeah, and you should feel guilty.
Yeah,
don't do that.
But yeah, I thought it was a funny observation because I feel a little pang every time I do that. I don't know why. I feel like I'm cheating because you could all easily look on Wikipedia and read this stuff. You don't need me to read it to you. We've got a little bit more of a value add.
Yeah, people could, but who wants to? Nobody wants to freaking... they want to sit down. I know I do. If I'm listening to a show,
yeah,
I'm getting information. I don't want to have to go to other websites and read about the stuff that they talked about. It's just tell me it and then I can move on with my life and do other stuff.
I think it's far more reliable than people say that it is. But at the same time, I don't want to be like, Herman Melville had sex with a bear. And then, you know, at least I cited Wikipedia.
If you're unsure about its validity, you can cite the source. And if the is Wikipedia, then, you know, kind of gets you off the hook.
Gets me off the hook a little bit when the bear rights activists are coming after me.
Yeah, the Melville activists would be totally cool with that. But the
bear,
the bear people would be pissed.
That just adds to the legend. But if you're a bear guy, yeah.
Well, that concludes our comment show for June. Hopefully you enjoyed that. And please write comments on this comment show about things that you would like to hear us talk about in the future. And nothing's off limits. I mean, we'll talk about Chad's sex life.
Sure, we can talk around that. A lot of it's imaginary, so I don't know if you want to go down that road, man. It gets strange. I've listened to that Sethagu episode for totally different reasons than almost everybody else that listens to this show. Weird stuff, man.
Oh, golly.
That's all we're going to talk about on this episode. Thanks for tuning in, folks. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lanky, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Show comment show.
Regardless of what he said, we're at hppodcraft.com. Thanks, folks.
What's that? HP Podcast. Okay, whatever.
HPPodcast.com.